volunteers for the Pittsburgh Section Council for Jewish Women's Oral History Program. We are interviewing Mark Perlman. Dr. Perlman, would you tell us about your immediate family, your grandparents, your parents, and your siblings, their names, the town that they came from in Europe, and the approximate dates?
Much of the material about my father, Selig Perlman, is in an interview I gave Leon Fink. It was published in one of the professional journals, and I've given copies to you. So his rather interesting story is already available on paper. His name was Selig Perlman. He was born in Bialystok in Tsarist Russia in 1888. His parents, Mordecai and Pesha, or Pauline Perlman, had been, they were raised in Bialystok, and he brought them to America in 1914. By that time, he had a younger brother, Jacob, who was born almost 10 years after he was born. Jacob, in due course, took his doctorate at the University of Wisconsin. Wilbur Cohen, who was the person popularly credited with bringing Medicare into legislation, mentioned at Jacob's retirement party that the idea of Medicare was Jacob's. Jacob, unfortunately, perhaps, is best known by the fact that his daughter is Judith Martin, otherwise known as Miss Manners. But Jacob's contributions to American culture and American society were quite monumental, irrespective of the popular qualities of Miss Martin's column. My father came to America in 1908. He was brought here, as this article indicates, by William English Walling, a rather well-known socialist figure. And after working briefly for Walling, he was encouraged by Walling to go to the University of Wisconsin to study under Richard Ely and John R. Commons. His relationship with Ely tended to be rather tempestuous, and Ely fired him in 1921, there was a palace revolution against Ely, not necessarily in my father's name, and Ely became an emeritus shortly thereafter and continued to work in the field of economics. My father's major teacher was John R. Commons, and his relationship with Commons is very well related in this article, and I think it probably wise to let anyone who wants to know about it read the article. My mother was born in 1894. She was the daughter of Samuel Shimon Schaber, S-H-A-B-E-R, and his wife, Dora Tickton. My mother was the first child of this couple born in America. She had two older sisters who had been born in Bialystok, and she was the product of my grandmother's arrival in America. And if there is anything to the theory that a happy woman produces a serene child, it was certainly the case that my mother was a very serene woman. My knowledge of my mother is somewhat limited. She died when I was 6 years old. She was a relatively remarkable woman. She was the first Jewish girl to go to normal school in the state of Massachusetts, and the first Jewish school teacher in New Hampshire. About 10 years ago, someone sent me an article by a woman who was raised in Nashville, New Hampshire, where my mother was born and lived. The article went into considerable detail about this marvelous first grade teacher that this woman had had. Well, it turns out that woman was my mother. I have since gotten to know the author of the article quite well, but her stories about my mother are very interesting to me. My memory of my mother is that she was quite a strict disciplinarian. She was a woman of strong convictions, of great energy, and of great public consciousness. She felt that she represented the best in American Jewish culture, and that she represented the best in Yankee culture. And this gave an amalgam which did not necessarily look as either simply Jewish culture or Yankee culture. In any event, my mother was quite active in the years that she was married to my father, of which there were only 12. She had two children, the older of whom, my brother David, became a research biochemist. He was the chief microbiologist at SQIB, and afterwards took the Guggenheim Fellowship and became a professor and then dean at the University of Wisconsin, where my father, as I mentioned earlier, had been trained and had remained as a professor until his shortly before
dean of what?
In 1959. My father was professor of economics.
No, your father, David.
My father, David, was a professor of biochemistry in the School of Pharmacy. It was an effort on the part of the administration of the University of Wisconsin to make the School of Pharmacy more research-oriented rather than simply the training ground for the pharmacists in the state. I might add, in mentioning about my brother, that when he was nominated to become head of the School of Pharmacy, the Pharmaceutical Association in the state took great exception. And in Wisconsin, since the University of Wisconsin in Madison is located in the capital, whatever happens to the university is frequently debated in the state legislature. And it was the question of his fitness to become dean of the School of Pharmacy, given the fact that he was not trained as a pharmacist, quickly became an issue on the floor of the lower house of the legislature. What the proponents of the, or what the leaders of his opposition did not reckon was that a great many of my father's students were members of that same house. And the debate quickly ended by members of the house who had been my father's students getting up and speaking long and favorably about my father's influence on their life. In any case, he became dean of the School of Pharmacy. He died young. He died at 60. Also, after only 12 years of marriage, he sought to die on the 50th anniversary of our mother's death. He had a cancer, but he missed it by 10 minutes. So in that goal, he was somewhat foiled. Anyway, my mother and my father were married in 1918. My father was at that time an instructor at the University of Wisconsin. My father was, as this article indicates, was fired by Richard Ely for not having filled a part of the agreement that Ely had worked out with him. The agreement was the rewriting of Ely's rather famous book on the American labor movement, the one that had been published originally in 1886. And when my father came to rewrite it, he changed the interpretation completely, and Ely took umbrage at it. My father was then looking for a job. My mother at that time was about to have a baby, and my father thought he had a job at Cornell University, where the department recommended that he be appointed, but the president of Cornell, influenced by the pattern set at Harvard, refused to take the name of the Jew to the trustees, and so he did not get the job at Cornell. Incidentally, Sumner Slichter, S-L-I-C-H-T-E-R, leader, very well-known professor at Harvard, also a Madison boy, a friend of my father's, got the job. And my father went back to Wisconsin, where a palace revolution was led by Mrs. Cummins, John R. Cummins' wife. And the resolution was that Ely was voted out as chairman, the very famous American sociologist Ross, Edward Ellsworth Ross, was given his own department of sociology. Commons was given only graduate students. My father took over Commons as undergraduate work. And my father remained at the University of Wisconsin until he retired at age 70 in 1959. He was to teach at the University of Pennsylvania for the following year, but he died before the academic year began. So that is really the background. I was only to say one other thing about my mother, which I had meant to say earlier, that I remember coming home from school on the second Tuesday of September, or maybe third Tuesday of September in 1929, and my mother asking me how the reading was coming. And I said that it wasn't. And she said, "Oh, what does the teacher do?" The teacher's name was Scarseth, S-C-A-R-S-E-T-H, as I recall. I said, "Well, Miss Scarseth holds up a card with a word on it, and you're supposed to know the word, but I don't know the word." And my mother said to me, "This is Tuesday, by Friday you will know how to read. Some children read with their eyes, but I think you have to learn to read with your ears." And so that followed the 1 week of solid hell, as I recall it. I would come home from school, I would be given lunch, I would take my mandatory nap. Mother was strong on naps. And then we would go to work. And after half an hour or so, I would insist it was too hard. She would shake me and say, "It is not too hard." I would insist it was too hard. She would spank my bottom and send me off to my room crying. After I stopped crying, the door would open and there would be Mother again. We would go downstairs and go back to work. Well, on Friday, when I came home from school, Mother said, "How was the reading?" And I said, "I'm the best in the class." And she said, "How's that?" And I said, "Well, the word is phone, P-H-O-N-E. And she said, I said, "Miss Scarset said to me, how did you know that the word was phone?" And I said, "Because G-H and P-H make the F sound." Now, I always used to tell my students that there were four things about that week that I learned. The first was that with adrenaline, you can do on Friday what you cannot do on Tuesday. If there's enough adrenaline, you can even learn to read by Friday, if you cannot read on Tuesday. The third thing that I learned was I learned how to read. Well, that probably would have happened anyway, but it was the adrenaline experience which has affected my view of the teaching process. Unfortunately, these days one can't encourage too much adrenaline amongst one's students. It's called harassing the student. But nonetheless, the students have been poor for the absence of it. Now, the last thing that I learned that week, which was a very personal tragedy to me, was that my memory of my mother was that she was very severe. Yet the people who knew her tell me that she was a first-class serene sweetie pie. But I remember her as the person who spanked my bottom and said, "You can learn to read, just concentrate." She died 4 months later, and 6-year-old children are not terribly equipped to see the sweetness in their mother if the mother was involved in learning how to read under duress.
That's very interesting. It brings us into your early life. What can you tell us about your other early years as far as other influences after your mother died, and what kind of schooling you had? Did you have Jewish schooling too?
I have written this out in another essay which was published in the American Economist in December 1995, and will appear in a book of my own essays coming out this year. And perhaps people who are interested can go into that in some detail. Here, let me say the following. My father, shortly after my mother's death, married my mother's younger sister. It was considered a marriage which was proposed by my mother's parents. On the surface, it looked like a good idea. Presumably, my stepmother, who was my aunt, would look after the interests of her sister's children, and all would be serene. I don't think it worked out that way. My stepmother, whatever may have been her intentions, quickly learned that she was clearly my father's second choice. And though he was very faithful to her and very dutiful to her, he always referred to my mother as his wife. And this must have been terribly painful for my stepmother. They had two children, and perhaps characteristic of my place in the household.
What was her first name?
Her first name was Fanny, F-A-N-N-I-E. My place in the household is pretty much summarized in my mind by the following story. When I was seven, my father took me for a walk and said that he and my stepmother were having a child, the first of two. And the reason was that every woman was entitled to have two children of her own, and that the family would then be four children. Now, somehow, this conversation between a rather distinguished, my father, as the articles will indicate, was a very distinguished professor, and a seven-year-old boy, as I think about it now, approaches the ridiculous. But as I recall the conversation, it seemed to me it was on the level of almost all our other conversations, and that it seemed to me a perfectly reasonable explanation to give to a seven-year-old boy. Well, indeed, they did have two daughters, and the household was rent with a considerable tension. My older brother had the capacity to discipline our stepmother by saying, often in tears, if mother hadn't died, I could have had, or I would have had. But I, being a horse's ass, or even worse, the worst kind of fool, never realized what a wonderful ploy this was, and never employed it. A consequence of which was that I always felt that my older brother had the family somewhat terrorized, and when I wanted to make a point, instead of terrorizing the family, I made a fool of myself. In any event, we were raised, pretty much the same way, boys and the girls. We all played in the band and the orchestra. My brother played the clarinet, I played the French horn. One sister played the cello, and the younger one played the viola. In 1938 and 39, my father took a position at the University College of Wales in Cardiff, and I went to the Cardiff High School for Boys. For me, it was a marvelous experience. I was very marginal in the Madison Social Society. Jewish children were very marginal then. One of my high school classmates, Lawrence Weinstein, L-A-U-R-E-N-C-E, Weinstein, later became president of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin. And in a recent book by him, entitled How to Move a Battleship with Your Bare Hands, he described the marginality of Jewish children in Madison in the 1930s. In any event, when I went to Cardiff, I recall that this was the first time I ever referred to myself as an American. Had I referred to myself as an American in Madison in the 1930s, I would have been corrected by my teachers, who would have said, "You are a Jewish." I recall my shop teacher, Roger Trafford, who later became principal of the junior high school and then the high school where I attended, met me on the street in the 1950s and said to me, "Mark, I cannot imagine how I told the Ikey stories with you in the class. When I think about it, I'm just frightened that I could have done such things." But they were done. That was the atmosphere of life in Madison. And I mention that because although I had considerable Jewish education, the fundamental Jewish identification I had was put on me by the by my classmates. I stayed out of school for all of the Jewish holidays, and my teachers always commented unfavorably in class that you are absent again because of those Jewish holidays. So one knew one was Jewish, if for no other reason than society reminded you of it. Originally, my original Hebrew education started after my mother died, when I was living for 6 months with my grandparents. And I remember learning the Hebrew alphabet and the fundamentals of the Jewish rhythm of life from my grandparents. I particularly remember my grandfather benching after each meal. I remember his washing his hands after he made the bracha before every meal. So the family of my grandfather's household was more observant than my own. Although my mother was Shomar Kasher and Shomar Shabbat. And I remember that we were not permitted to tear paper or even fold paper on Shabbos. But the intensity of the Jewish community life was not something which I noticed in Madison. My father believes that my Hebrew education was not at Cheder. For reasons not clear to me now, my aunt's stepmother did not want my brother and me to go to the local cheder. Instead, we were given private instruction. And I had a series of Hebrew teachers who came in twice a week and gave me lessons. Most of them were my father's graduate students or undergraduate students who needed the dollar an hour, which in those days was real money, which they got for teaching me. One of them later became a rather famous ambassador to Hungary, ambassador to Vienna, Philip, P-H-I-L-I-P, the Kaiser. Incidentally, his son is now the managing editor of the Washington Post. Kaiser and his brother, Henry, were in sequence my Hebrew teachers. Phil Kaiser told a nice story about me as a Hebrew student when he was ambassador in Vienna, and I was the guest of honor at the Thanksgiving Day dinner. He reported that he came down to my father after the second lesson and said, "Mark has very little interest in learning Hebrew." My father said, I know, but you're a good influence on him. Moreover, you need the dollar an hour. Stick with it." In any case, I was very much interested in Hebrew, in Jewish history, but I was not particularly interested in learning Hebrew. Learning Hebrew in those days largely meant translating the Tanakh. And from the standpoint of learning, I think it was too advanced a text for a small boy. It was just too hard. In any event, I was bar mitzvah. By this time, Phil Kaiser had gone off to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, and his older brother Henry, who was in the law school at Wisconsin, took over the tuition. When it came time for me to be bar mitzvah, Henry noted that he did not have much of a voice. And so one of the other members of the group that lived together, a wonderful man by the name of Ben Stefanski, also a distinguished Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, was the musical consultant. In any case, I had a bar mitzvah, and think, like a great many Jewish boys of my age and disposition, decided that he had had enough Hebrew education. When I entered the University of Wisconsin in 1941, the director of the Hillel Foundation was a preeminent scholar by the name of Max Kadushin. Kadushin later became professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was also a very close friend of my parents. And Max Kadushin began to give us a big series of lectures on Judaism. And I remember being totally fascinated by these lectures and attending them with a sort of intensity that I reserved for the only other person for whom I had such intensity in listening was my father, who would spend a great deal of time with me, as I indicated in these two printed interviews, each week, giving me his interpretation of events and why he interpreted them as he did. The Kadushin had the same impact on me, and much of my interest in Judaism really comes from the Kadushin experience. I mention this because our generation, remember I was born in 1923, our generation came to much of our current attitude towards Judaism because of the fact of the Holocaust and the even more pressing fact of the number of European refugee Jews in 1945, 46, and 47. Whatever may have been our feelings about things Jewish, the fact that so many Jews had been killed, and a smaller number, but no less desperate was the plight of these Jews in the DP camps, that for our generation, Jewish identification meant peoplehood, not necessarily a religious commitment. And as I will say later on in these interviews, I came to recognize this profound identification with the problems of the Jews of Europe, first in 1946 and 47, and later in 1956, when Eisenhower abrogated all the agreements that we thought the United States had made with Israel. And so for the rest of our lives, we have been very much identified with the need to protect Israel. But I'm getting well ahead of my story. My older brother was much more observant than I as a youngster. He was Shomer Shabbat until I think he was through high school. I was not. My older brother was much more concerned about the dietary laws than I was. But then I was in the army, and he was not, and service in the army tended to homogenize one's culture considerably. In any event, that is the...
I'd like to go back, stop.
My upbringing.
I'd like to go back just briefly. When did your grandfather and mother come here? But you forgot that.
Now, my mother's parents, my mother's father came to America in 1890. He became a backpedaler, and within a few years had amassed enough money to bring his wife over and his two children. My mother was the third child. He established a store in New Hampshire. He was a very interesting person. Once he established the store, he had become something of a local fixture in Nashua, New Hampshire. The Episcopalian minister used to come by every Thursday morning to go over the cedra with my grandfather, since this minister would base his sermon on the cedra. Now, as I go through my grandfather's things, I was amazed to discover that he had become a patron of the 1905 Jewish Encyclopedia in the 1890s, at a time when he was either a backpedaler or had just opened the store. He's listed in the back of the last volume as a patron. This indicates a certain degree of commitment. More than that, it's quite clear that he was, that he knew the Midrash very well. How much of the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Gemara, he knew, I don't know. And how well he knew it, I don't know. But he was certainly aware of some of the blots, they said, the pages of the Talmud. At the Jewish Theological Seminary, graduates are supposed to know approximately 1,000 blots. I would be very much surprised if my grandfather knew more than 100, but considering that he had gone to work when he was 7 or 8 years of age, that indicates some kind of commitment. My father's parents were brought over by him in 1914 when my grandfather Perlman was economically quite destitute. The great problems of humiliation that bringing my grandparents to Madison had on my father are discussed in this interview that I gave to Leon Fink about my father's career. The point that I stress here is that my